I'm Matt. If you don't know me, I'm on the teaching team at Everyday Church. I'm going to be sharing the message today. So we're in a series right now called The Upside Down Kingdom. And throughout this series, we're looking at different stories from the book of Luke, which is like a narrative history of Jesus's life and ministry on earth. And then also we're looking at stories later in the series from the book of Acts, which is kind of like a sequel to the book of Luke. And it documents the early history of the church. And we're looking at how these, they're different stories in these two books, how they really established sort of these countercultural values. And that's where we got this idea of this upside down kingdom. So throughout Jesus's life and throughout the history of the church, we see time and time again where, you know, the prevailing culture of the world and the values of the world were kind of turned upside down. And so we're looking at different stories from those two books and seeing how those values that were established throughout the Bible, how they might still pertain to us today, how they might apply to our lives as Christians and to our church here 2,000 years after all that happened. So I'm just going to pray, and then we'll jump in. God, we thank you for bringing us here today. We just invite your spirit into this room. And just ask that you would communicate truth to us through your word. Lord, I pray that you would speak through me, that these words would not be mine, but they would be yours. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So I'm just going to start out with telling a story about growing up. So I had a pretty good childhood growing up. I am one of two kids. I have a younger sister, and I grew up with both parents in like a, kind of a suburban community. And, you know, it was a really good childhood, honestly. Like, I'm blessed and thankful for the childhood that I had. But, like, the street that I grew up on, there was, like, filled with kids. Every you know, house had multiple kids. And every day, all we did was just play sports, play outside, like, all the time. You know, we played any sport you can think of. We played baseball, basketball, soccer, hockey. We would invent our own sports just to, you know, just to have fun and pass the time. We had this one game where we played where there was like one of our neighbors had a trampoline, and everybody would jump on the trampoline, and there'd be two people on the sides of the trampoline with like footballs and soccer balls, probably baseballs, and trying to throw and hit the people jump on the trampoline. And whoever made it last jumping on the trampoline, that's the one who would win the game. So yeah, it was we had a fun time. We had a lot of fun as kids, and my parents were really, you know, they were awesome. Like, they gave us a ton of freedom. You know, it wasn't like this hover parenting style that a lot of people have. Sorry, no offense to anybody. But, you know, they just let us, you know, maybe they gave us too much freedom, actually. But, you know, they let us do what we want. Like, they didn't have too many rules. We could go outside and play as long as we were back by dark, pretty much. Like, actually, my dad, he would come outside when it was getting dark, and he would whistle. And, like, we knew his whistle. His whistle was unique to him. And when we heard that whistle, we had to get back. And if he had to whistle like more than one time, we were in trouble. But for the most part, they were super, you know, they give us a lot of freedom. But there was one rule that my mom had that was a little, you know, one thing that she was kind of strict about. And that is that, well, she's kind of a neat freak. Like, things have to be perfectly, spotlessly clean. That's like her one thing. You know, things have to be clean. So if we wanted to go outside and play after school, or, you know, on the weekends in the morning, if we wanted to go outside, our rooms had to be perfectly clean. And, you know, like the basement area where my sister and I would play and hang out, like, it had to be clean. So the way that I handled the situation is I would pretty much just contain my mess into an area that was out of her line of sight. So, you know, I would take my clothes, I would take my mess, whatever it was, I just throw it in the closet. Or, you know, if I was cleaning the basement, I'd just throw stuff behind the TV or under the couch. Like, what, you know, especially if my friends were outside right then, like, come on, Matt. And then my mom's like, you got to clean first. I would just hide the mess real quick so I could, you know, so I could get outside. That was like torture, missing that time being outside with my friends. So, I'd get away with this for the most part, but it would always catch up to me eventually, because there would be that one day where my friend's knocking on the door telling me, you know, come on, we got five people. We need one more to make 3-on-3 basketball. And they're right outside. And the basketball hoop is in my driveway, too. So they're out there, come on, let's play. And then I'm like, all right. And then my mom's like, you got to clean your room. And I saw inside your closet. and that was it. It was over. There was no going outside. I mean, she would make me take everything out of my closet, everything out of my drawers. I'd have to reorganize everything and get it to be like perfectly spotless before I could go out and play. I'd be in there like a Saturday afternoon when it's beautiful outside and all my friends are in my driveway playing basketball. I can hear them, and I'm in there like folding clothes all mad. That happened pretty regularly growing up. So the moral of that story is that, you know, I could get my room or the basement to a place where it appeared clean. It appeared that everything was together, everything was put together. But really, if you look beneath the surface, things were actually a mess. They really weren't together at all. And that leads us to the story that we're going to look at today. And it's a passage in Luke, from Luke chapter 11. And it's a story of a confrontation that Jesus had with this Pharisee and with a group of Pharisees and religious leaders of his day. And really, he's kind of calling them out for this very thing of sort of portraying this pure, clean lifestyle when really on the inside, things were not the way they should be. So this story starts in verse 37 of Luke 11. And it takes place right after Jesus had just healed a demon-possessed boy. He healed this demon-possessed boy, and big crowds started to gather around to hear him teach. And that's where our story picks up. This is kind of a little bit of a long passage that I'm going through, so just a disclaimer. I'm just going to kind of go verse for verse and just kind of break down what it's saying, what it's, you know, what happened. And then after I go through the passage, I'll come back and we'll see how it might apply to us. So bear with me. All right, verse 37. It says, when Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table. So while Jesus was teaching this crowd, clearly there were Pharisees there listening to him. And if you don't know who the Pharisees were they were like a group of religious leaders. They were like the gatekeepers of the Jewish religion, and they were meticulous about following the scriptures and making sure that people were following the Old Testament laws that God established with the nation of Israel. And by this point in Jesus' life, he already kind of had sort of a contentious relationship with the Pharisees. There had been like a few times where he kind of called them out publicly in front of people for being hypocrites. They didn't really get along. And we don't know, like, the motivation of this Pharisee. We're not sure if he was inviting Jesus into his home because he wanted to catch him saying or doing something that he shouldn't, or if he was genuinely curious or open to what Jesus had to say. But either way, we know that this Pharisee invited Jesus into his home, and we know that Jesus accepted the invitation. And then verse 38, it says, but the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. So a general practice in that culture would be to wash your hands before you eat. And this wasn't done like we do that now, but we do it for hygiene. In this culture, they were doing it to cleanse themselves from impure spirits. So they weren't doing it, you know, to be clean from germs. It's to cleanse themselves from any type of impurity. And this was something that the Pharisees sort of instated on top of God's law. So there were things within the Old Covenant law that God commanded his people to do in order to make sure that they weren't impure, because there was a lot of idolatry and idol worship and all these different religions, and he didn't want his people to fall into that. So he had these different regulations and ways to make sure that you were clean. And this practice of washing the hands, the Pharisees would take water and they would pour it over the top of their hands and the back of their hands, and some theologians believe they would wash their arm all the way up to their elbow before they ate. This wasn't actually in the Bible. This was something that they added. They added on to the scripture. So the Pharisees noticed that Jesus did not partake in this practice. And then it says in verse 39, then the Lord said to him, I'm going to pause there for one quick second, because it's interesting that the Pharisee didn't say anything to Jesus about not washing his hands. He just says that he noticed that Jesus didn't wash his hands. And then Jesus spoke to him about that thought that he was having, which I think, I mean, that freaked me out if it was me. I don't know about you. But so Jesus knew what he was thinking. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also?" So another ritual that the Pharisees would do is they would take water and they would pour it over the outside of their cups and dishes and over the inside also in order to make sure that they were clean. And Jesus is telling them that you Pharisees are like cups and dishes that are clean on the outside, but on the inside are actually impure. And then he goes on to point out the specific sin that the Pharisees are guilty of that is making them impure, and that is greed and wickedness. But now, verse 41, "But now, as for what is inside you, be generous to the poor, and everything will be clean for you." So the Pharisees, they thought that their rituals and these different things that they were doing, these different practices and rules that they created, that those were the things that were making them clean and pure in God's eyes. But Jesus is telling them it's not those things that actually makes you pure and clean. What makes you pure and clean is generosity. Be generous to the poor. And this is a major theme that runs all throughout the entire Bible, is this idea of generosity. And it's a value that's integral to this concept, this series that we're in of the upside down kingdom. And it's one of the things that Jesus came to this earth to establish, and that the church today is supposed to be defined by and known for, is our generosity. In verse 42, he says, "Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone." So now he shows us that the Pharisees were meticulous in their tithing. So tithing is giving 10% of what you have to God. And they were not only giving their income, they were actually going into their garden and cutting 10% of each of their herbs and plants and spices and giving those to God also. And it's interesting because Jesus said that it's not bad that you're doing that. You should do that. You know, but you should have practiced the latter. You should have done that. You should have given to me and tithed to me and practiced these rituals without leaving the former undone, which is caring about justice. He rebukes them for neglecting justice. Jesus saw this whole appearance, this portrayal of this religious lifestyle that the Pharisees were giving off, while the poor and marginalized in society were not being cared for by them. And that's what led him to call them out, led him to give them this rebuke. He says to them, "You want to be clean before God, be generous to the poor, and don't neglect justice." Then verse 43, he keeps going. This rebuke does not stop. It's like 10 verses long. "Woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces." So the Pharisees, they wanted to be seated in the synagogue in a place that was that showed that they were of the highest position in authority. They wanted to be looked up to. And Jesus is rebuking them for this as well and saying it's not about that. It's not about pride. And he establishes another upside-down kingdom value in addition to generosity and justice. And that is this idea of humility. And then Jesus goes in verse 44 for the knockout punch against the Pharisees. And he says, "Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves, which people walk over without knowing it." The whole thing that started this confrontation was this idea of being ritually pure or being ceremonially clean. And the one thing in this society that was most seen as impure was dead bodies. And Jesus is telling these Pharisees who are trying so hard to be clean and to be pure that they're actually like unmarked graves where people walk over them. When people come into contact with them, they are made unclean, which is a very, very harsh thing to say. You think that you think that doing all these practices, partaking in all these things, are making you clean and pure, but really, you're like dead bodies, and you're actually making it harder for all the people around you to have access to God. And then, in verse 45, we are introduced to another group of people that were in the same circle. And it says, one of the experts in the law answered him, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also." So the experts in the law, they were in the same circle as the Pharisees, but they were actually a little higher in status. And as Jesus is there just going off on the Pharisees, you know, I think it started to hit a little close to home to these teachers in the law. They practiced a lot of the same things. I'm not sure of this, but I think that they may have wanted to hear Jesus absolve them from this rebuke that he was giving to the Pharisees. And this is how Jesus responds. He says, "And you experts in the law, woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them." Jesus told them that they're doing the same thing that the Pharisees are doing. They're making following God, they're making a relationship and connection and access to God more complicated and more difficult than it's supposed to be. Rather than loving and supporting the people, they're actually holding people back. Verse 47, we're almost through this. Verse 47, "Woe to you, because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your ancestors who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your ancestors did. They killed the prophets, and you build their tombs. Therefore, this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world." So he's telling the teachers of the law, he's telling the religious leaders that it was their ancestors who are guilty for the blood of all the prophets. And the prophets were people who God raised up in the Old Testament to go and to speak to his people, his nation of Israel, when they tended to get off course and to stray away from him. And what's interesting is if you look at the Old Testament and you read through the history of Israel, oftentimes the reason that he raised up these prophets was the same reason that he's rebuking the Pharisees right here. It was because they neglected justice and they began to oppress people and take advantage of the vulnerable people in the society. And that is why he raised up prophets to go and to communicate truth to the nation of Israel, to try to help them change their course and turn back to God. And so he's telling these religious leaders that their ancestors are the ones who are guilty for killing all of those prophets, and that they are now going to be ultimately held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that was shed. And what he's referring to is what's going to happen in a short while, you know, very shortly after this story, is that they are going to have him killed. Because Jesus is the ultimate prophet, the ultimate messenger of truth who's coming and trying to communicate the love of God and the heart of God to us. And they are going to have him put on trial and crucified and killed. Woe to you when Jesus went outside. I have a lot of pages, sorry. When Jesus went outside, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to beseech him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. So after all these rebukes, after all, you know, these challenge that Jesus just gave to the teachers of the law and to the Pharisees, they had enough. It was too much for them. They were done with it. This guy was challenging their authority. He was calling them out and embarrassing them to a degree. And now they were going to make a plan to catch him and to persecute him. So that's the passage that I'm preaching out of today. That is the story that we're looking at. And the question that now we need to try to answer as a community and as Christians is, what does this story have to do with us? What does this rebuke that Jesus gave to these Pharisees How does it relate to us today as Christians here? So I think the first thing that we should do is humble ourselves and realize that us as church people, as religious people, as people who call ourselves Christians and who come together regularly to practice our religion, we have to remember that there's a temptation for us to fall into the same things that the Pharisees fell into, to fall into those same sins where our coming together and our, you know, worshiping and doing the things that we do, it can't become about that in and of itself. It's one expression of the love of God that's in our heart, right? Is this time that we spend together and the different things that we do together and the way we operate as a church. But this worship is only one expression of that. We should have that. The same way that Jesus said to the Pharisees, tithing and doing these things, these are good things. You should have done those, but you should not have ignored justice. You should have been generous to the poor. So we have to figure out how this is one expression of the love of God inside of us, but it's not the only expression. That we're also expressing the love of God through standing in solidarity with marginalized people and by showing, practicing justice and compassion as a community together. So I want to let you all know that I think here at Everyday Church, we're actually doing a really good job at this. We really have some things going on, and a lot of you are connected to some of these things. Some of you might not be. So I just want to share a couple of the things that are important to us as a church and things that are going on, maybe it's kind of behind the surface, that I think that we should all be aware of. So the first one that I want to tell you about is a nonprofit organization that's called Viva Uptown. So Viva Uptown is a brand new community development corporation that just launched recently, and it's committed to this very idea of seeking equality and justice for everyone in our community. And it's a community-based organization. It's based in Washington Heights and Inwood. And it was started by several different Christian leaders in our community. And one of those leaders was our pastor, Larry. So I just want to, you can clap for that. Someone who's Larry helped to launch this organization, and he's on the board of this organization. And I just wanted all of you to know that. I think we all should know that, to know that as a church, we are trying to figure out how to live out these concepts and these upside-down kingdom values of generosity and justice. And our pastor is representing us in that. And he's going before us, and he's going to figure out, what does this look like for us, and how can we do this? And he's leading in that way, and he's going to help bring us along and figure out how we, as a church body, as a community, can be an ally for justice and for peace in our community. The other thing that's going on right now that I want everyone to know about, and a lot of you have been a part of these conversations, but over the last month, some of the leaders in our church, we've been going through a study on diversity, about multi-ethnic ministry and multi-ethnic church. And, this study, it's gotten really real, and it really goes deep, just wrestling through different issues of justice in America and segregation along racial lines, but also ethnic and economic lines. And it really gets very real about the role that the church in the United States has played in contributing to that segregation and often causing injustices unintentionally. So, I mean, I've taught a little bit on this before, but if you don't know, like, there's a principle that a lot of denominations and churches use in order to grow their churches. It's called the homogeneous unit principle. And that's basically just a fancy way of saying same. It's just a strategy where churches target a certain demographic, a specific type of person, and then they shape their ministry and their services, whatever they do, just to kind of be a product that's then marketed to that certain demographic. And it's actually a great way to grow a church really quickly, but unfortunately, it's not a biblical principle. And also, what history has shown us is that tends to actually perpetuate a lot of injustices that exist in society because people don't understand other people. They can't relate to their stories or to the struggles and the different things that they go through. So at Everyday Church, we've recognized that diversity is one way that we can fight and we can confront injustice in our community. There's very few organizations actually in our neighborhood and area, and very few churches that are diverse. And we've decided that we want to kind of draw a line in the sand and say we're gonna work our hardest and we're gonna do our best to fully reflect and represent the full vast diversity ethnically, economically, and in every sense that you can imagine that is in our community. So I just wanted to let you know that that's another thing that's going on. There are ways that we are doing this, and we want to invite everybody into that conversation. We're just kind of just getting it started and figuring out how we're going to do that. But these things are definitely happening and ongoing. So one other thing I want to touch on coming out of this passage is this idea of truth-telling that Jesus was doing. So he was really stepping up and challenging the Pharisees and the religious leaders. And he was speaking difficult truth to them. He was confronting them. And I think that we as Christians and as a church, we need to model our Christianity off of Jesus. That's what it is. You know, Christ in Christ, that's what we are. And we need to be a community that reflects these upside-down kingdom values of generosity, of justice and humility. But we also need to be a prophetic voice. We need to be willing to and bold enough to speak truth to power. And I'm going to go on a little tangent. don't take all this to be like out of the Bible, but this is my interpretation. I believe that in our culture today, in society, there's sort of a dominant narrative. There's a way of thinking about things and thinking about the world that has kind of been passed down, and that shapes the mentality, the mindset of most everyone who grew up here, or even, you know, and it even extends beyond that. But it's communicated and transmitted through our music and through art and through our education. And just the way that the world is organized. And I believe personally that this dominant way of thought, this mentality, in large part, is oppressive and is contrary to these upside-down kingdom values. People have different names, different ways of referring to this idea, but I'll call it the establishment. So I believe that the church, we're supposed to be a prophetic community of truth. We're not supposed to be an agent of this establishment or this way of thinking. But sadly, in many ways, I believe that the church in our country is captive to this way of understanding the world that's largely based on worldly values rather than upside down kingdom values. The church is not supposed to be captive to this establishment. We're not supposed to be an agent of this power structure, because ultimately it marginalizes and oppresses people. And this is the very thing that Jesus was criticizing the religious leaders for being the killers of the prophets, for being the killers of Jesus, the killers of this truth that he was trying to bring to them. We're supposed to be a community of compassion and justice that stands in solidarity with those people that are at the margins, and in a community that gives a voice to the voiceless, and that speaks truth to the power that is around us. And the reason that I talk about this stuff, and you know, a lot of times, even just in conversations with me, this type of thing comes up. And the reason that I do it is because I believe that that's what Jesus did. And here at Everyday Church, we're doing our best, those of us that are up here teaching and preaching, to really teach about this Jesus from the Bible, and not to water him down and mold him to fit our own cultural ways of thinking or ways of life. We're trying to figure out how Jesus challenges those ways rather than trying to fit him into those ways. So I want to just close with a story that I think does a great job of just illustrating these values that Jesus established for us in the passage that we read today. So back in 2015, while I was spending some time in Dominican Republic, I got to work with this awesome, incredible church called Iglesia Comunitaria Cristiana, ICC, or ICC. And this church is in La Zona Colonial, the colonial zone of downtown Santo Domingo. And this church is, the neighborhood is kind of a tourist destination. It's where the cruises dock, so there's always tourists coming through. There's a lot of people passing through very often there. And so because of that, there's a lot of homeless people, a lot of beggars, a lot of people living on the streets in this part of Santo Domingo. And so this church that we were working with, when it started down there in this neighborhood, pretty early on, it noticed, wow, there's a lot of people living on the streets down here. And there's a lot of people who are hungry and who don't have food. And so this church, in their parking lot area, they built a kitchen in the back of the parking lot. And they began to invite the people off the streets to come and to have a meal actually every day. They cook so much. They cook for 70 people 5 days a week. And it's all volunteer-run soup kitchen. And it's an amazing, amazing ministry. And there's dozens of people in the church who have come to know the Lord and who have come off the streets, who have turned away from addictions as a result of encountering the love of Christ through this ministry, this soup kitchen that's there. So after years of running this soup kitchen, the leaders of the church noticed that even among this group of homeless people, there was a percentage that were even more at risk than the rest. And most of these people were elderly and had, you know, physical and mental handicaps and had no family left. Nobody there to take care of them. They were living on the streets 24/7 with nobody left for them. And so the church, in the little parking lot area, tiny parking lot, they built like a dormitory area, and they put 9 beds in there, and they hired a nurse to come there every single day, and they said, you know what, nobody's taking care of these at-risk people, these elderly people who have been abandoned by their families, we're going to take care of them. And those people, there's 9 of them, you know, if you're in La Zona Colonial, and you see elderly, handicapped, beggars on the street, those people live at the church and are taken care of and are provided for and are fed and are bathed at the church. It's just an incredible, incredible ministry, an incredible example of this idea of generosity. Well, there was one person specifically who lived in that, and lives to this day in that dorm that made a huge impression on me. And her name was Altagracia. Kayla knows her. And Altagracia, she was handicapped. She could not walk, and she was mentally handicapped. She had a hard time holding a conversation. But she lived right there next to the church. And every time that there was a church service, everyone that came into the parking lot before walking into the entrance of the church, they would see Altagracia. Altagracia would be sitting right there on the porch, right outside the dormitory nursing home area, and she would greet everyone as they walked in. And every person that walked in to go into church, before they walked into church, they would walk over to Altagracia, and they would hug her, and they would kiss her, and they would ask her how she was doing, and they would have a conversation with her, and they would just show her immense amounts of love. And it's an amazing church overall. It's an amazing ministry, the soup kitchen, that they're feeding people, that they're taking care of people, the nursing home, that they're housing the most marginalized and at-risk people in their community. They really are showing this love in such a prophetic and profound way. But the thing that I found most moving wasn't either of those things, but it was the dignity that they showed Altagracia that they showed her that though everyone had abandoned her, though all her family had left her behind, that they were there to treat her as a human being, that she still was a human being, and that she was loved by them and she was loved by God. And in my opinion, that is the upside down kingdom. That is what this is all about. It's about living with justice and generosity and humility and compassion, counterculturally to the ways of this world. I don't know exactly how this looks for us, for everyday church, in the long term. I don't know what it looks for us, what it looks like for us. But I do know that we are taking the right steps. I know that we're asking the right questions. I know that we're wrestling through the difficult tensions in our community and in our world, and we're trying to figure out how we can be a community that reflects the beautiful love of Christ.